They're doing a CYA. I don't know if you know what it is.
No, what is that?
Well, cover your ass.
Oh.
And there's, okay, the reason for that is so many men have a diagnosis of prostate cancer. They're not sure if it's a rabbit or a turtle.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Thanks so much for tuning in.
New insight about the largest mass suicide of modern times, the Jonestown Massacre.
Then, who says we're past our prime? The invention of middle age.
Plus, tips for renovating and updating just about any space.
Then, the latest on that unpleasant annual ritual for middle-aged men, the prostate screening test.
And we'll shoot the breeze about some simple chair exercises to boost your energy. Those of us of a certain age can remember where we were when we first heard about the 1978 Jonestown Massacre, the largest mass suicide of modern times. It was that shocking and horrendous, and truly one of those moments where time stood still.
Masterminded by cult leader Jim Jones of the People's Temple, 913 people, a third of them children, died after drinking poison fruit punch in the tiny South American country of Guyana. Now, more than four decades later, using newly released FBI documents and interviews with survivors, Julia Shears recounts how decent people can be taken in by a charismatic and crazed tyrant. She chronicles it all in her book, A Thousand Lives. Welcome to the program, Julia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I sure remember where I was when I heard about this massacre. The fact that all those people could die in one place and, you know, within a few hours was just unbelievable because of one crazy man. But can you tell us what it was about Jim Jones that drew people to him and his church, at least initially?
Initially, he started out as a Methodist preacher in Indianapolis, Indiana, where I'm from. And he had a very good message. He came into view in the 1950s as a civil rights leader. He preached a message from early on about social justice against racism and sexism and elitism. With his message, he attracted a large congregation of African Americans, and he would take his congregation and go to the rich parts of town, to white-only churches, and just march in and have them sit down to see how they would be greeted. And a lot of times it didn't go well. They were called names. They would open all the windows to try and freeze them out. So he had this very aggressive message of equal rights back in the 50s. And he gained the accolades of everybody in the town, of all of the progressive-minded politicians. And, you know, this is really what launched his career as Jim Jones and as a minister.
Okay, was Jim Jones himself, while he attracted an African-American community, was he African-American?
No, he was white, born dirt poor from a broken family. And he, you know, from my research and interviews, it seems like he just kind of landed on this notion that would gain him a lot of followers very quickly. You know, it is all debatable how much he actually believed in his own message of social equality.
Wasn't he also a follower of Harvey Milk, the aide to the
George
mayor
Moscone.
In San Francisco? Yes.
George Moscone.
Right. And he was sort of a force for good at that time, right? Especially with his work with George Moscone?
Oh, yeah. So by the time they moved from Indiana to Redwood Valley, California, and then finally to San Francisco in 1972, his church was well known. And he was courted by, like I said, all the progressive politicians. So the church had an immense outreach program. They would help single mothers by providing child care. They had nurses on hand that gave free medical care to the destitute elderly. And he also had this message that was very progressive at the time in a town where, you know, progressive politics were taken off. You know, San Francisco in the 70s was the place to be. So he quickly amassed a large following. And he was accepted by the politicians of the day and helped George Moscone win his election in 1975.
Well, Julia, as you had said earlier, he was an early advocate, or so it seemed, of integration. But
right.
Even then, weren't there a lot of signs that he was a very strange and deluded man?
There were. But the rank and file did not see any of those signs.
So what were they? Give us some examples.
Okay. So he had his inner circle, mainly white, who knew the other side of Jim Jones, the highly controlling side of the Jim Jones. There were some inklings among the rank and file. For example, he had everyone sign false confessions, making up lies that they were part of a revolution that wanted to overthrow the United States or had molested their daughters. I mean, it got really weird at a certain point. But by that time, the people were living communally, and it was really hard to get out. And here's the thing. He would have people sign these confessions saying that, you know, the church was attacked, somebody was trying to assassinate him, and so he needed people to sign these loyalty statements by lying. So if they turned against the church would use these statements to discredit them. And they would tell people, well, you know, we're never going to use these, but we want to know that you are really loyal to People's Temple and Jim Jones, and you'll never betray us. And so we're all going to sign these little forms. You know, we're never going to use them. Sometimes they were just blank pieces of paper that they would sign the bottom of. So by the time he became that controlling, like I said, everyone was living communally. They had gradually been cut off from their outside family members and loved ones, and it became really hard to leave the church.
Well, over the years, some did leave the church, correct?
That's right.
But it seemed from your book that there was really that defection of some of the best and brightest, would call the Gang of Eight, that really upset him the most. Can you tell us a little bit about this Gang of Eight?
Right. So in Redwood Valley, California, where the church moved after Indiana, there was a group of young people that was seeing the hypocrisy of the church and in Jim Jones. And they wrote this letter stating all of the reasons they thought the church was going in the wrong direction. And this made Jim Jones furious that anybody would dare criticize him. But this set a precedent where he really started to control the members, like I said, with the false confessions and by using threats. And that was just on the rank and file level. If you got to his inner circle, and especially the young women he chose as his concubines, several of them told me stories that were just incredible. How he was able to switch from this kind, middle-aged, benevolent pastor to this man who, during the middle of a church service, would tap them on the shoulder and lead them up to the upper floors of the church to have sex with them in the middle of a service and then go back down and finish delivering the sermon. It really was a power trip, ultimately, for Jim Jones at the end. He wanted to see how much he could push the envelope and control people.
What happened when he left the congregation? I mean, was it like, hold on, everybody, I'll be right back, or everyone's in choir singing?
Oh, it'd be during an offering, or the choir would be doing a couple of numbers, you know.
And did people know what he was doing?
No, he would just leave. The inner circle knew. So he is what psychiatrists say was a narcissistic personality order and a sensual psychopath. He loved attention. He was very charismatic. He was outspoken. He loved having sex. And in his followers, he found all of these willing acolytes, male and female. And this is one way that he not only compromised you, but that he won you over. He had so many admirers within his congregation, they felt it was an honor to be picked to have sex with Jim Jones.
Our guest is Julia Shears, author of 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Julia Shears about new insights into cult leader Jim Jones and the 1978 Jonestown Massacre.
Julia, why Guyana, where he moved his followers in the mid-1970s? And how did they manage to lure, you know, so many people? Mm-hmm. They gave up their lives. They moved their families. How did that happen?
So they picked Guyana because it was a socialist country, and People's Temple identified itself as socialist. It was English-speaking, and it was majority black. So it's a mix of black and the descendants of the Indian laborers that came over when it was owned by the British. So it mirrored basically the same demographic of People's Temple. That was of interest. And also, Guyana had put out a call internationally asking people to come and develop the hinterlands, the jungle of Guyana, to grow food. The country was having a food crisis. It had to import most of its food. And so the government was then trying to clear the jungle and move groups there to see if they could possibly grow sustainable agriculture in the highlands, which ended up being a failure. But, you know, Jim Jones heard about this, went down, bought this huge tract of land in northern Guyana, and then sent down pioneers to clear it and start growing crops. And this is going to be a model agricultural community. It failed miserably.
On that note, I mean, you write that once in Jonestown, members were treated absolutely horribly. So what were the conditions like?
First of all, they couldn't grow enough food. The soil was only a couple inches thick. It wasn't deep enough to grow. For example, they would try and grow carrots, and they'd be only as long as your thumb because it couldn't penetrate the clay beneath the topsoil. There was an infestation of every type of bug imaginable. There were weeds. They would go through cycles of drought and then just flooding that would wash away the seedlings. So there wasn't enough food. And then, you know, Jim Jones, to get people down there, told his congregation, come down, check it out. If you don't like it, he implied, you can leave. But what happened? They fly down to Georgetown, the capital of Guyana, loaded into a boat for a two-day boat journey through these jungle waterways up to the camp. And once they get there, their passports are confiscated, their money is taken, and Jim Jones tells them that if they want to go back to California, they can swim there because he's not paying their way back. And it quickly becomes clear that they are trapped down there and there's no way out and that their leader is going mad.
And didn't he also use drugs to kind of manage and hold people against their will?
He did. He built a clinic. And there was also something called the special care unit, where any troublemakers, anybody who spoke out against Jim Jones or refused to work, you know, it was even a crime to complain about the heat because it is jungle heat down there. You weren't allowed to complain about anything, not the food, not the heat, not the fact that your family was split up into different dormitories and cottages, and not about the overcrowding. So anybody who was a constant complainer or who tried to escape or shirked work was put into the special care unit, and he had a huge stock of Thorazine, which is this amazing sedative. It will knock you out. So he would sedate people with Thorazine, just shoot them up so they were completely incapacitated.
So how did Jim Jones get from A to B? He started this sort of utopia, what he thought would be a utopia. How did he come to the conclusion that his followers should die?
Well, here's the thing. From my research, I don't believe he ever thought of Jonestown as a permanent establishment. My research showed that in the early 70s, while he was still in San Francisco, he was talking about killing his followers. Again, this is partially to test their loyalty, but it's also because, as he told one of his closest concubines, he wanted to go down in history. He told her, he said, mark my words, I will go down in history.
So you think this was pre-planned?
Oh, yeah. Because in San Francisco, he talked about loading his followers onto a bus and driving it off the Golden Gate Bridge. And then at another time, he sent one of his concubines to flight school, and she learned how to fly an airplane. They're thinking about loading people onto an airplane and crashing it into the ocean. And then he came up with, you know, Jonestown. If he could relocate 1,000 people down to Jonestown, cut them off from society, and then kill them, the death toll would be that much larger. He would be even that much more famous.
Well, real quickly, Julia, I mean, it was absolutely horrifying to read that there were plenty of senior figures within the temple. I mean, these were very educated people who helped plan the massacre along with Jim Jones. And it was all horrifying, but one of the truly horrifying things for me was the medical director suggested mass shootings, the nurses volunteered to manage the massacre, and the dietitian came up with drinking poison. I mean, how do you explain this?
Right. Well, what Jim Jones did, it was twofold. His inner circle was comprised of people who were like him. They were nihilistic. They were depressives. They believed him. They were the true believers. And he was also lying to people constantly. He said that because they were socialists, the Guyanese army was coming to get them. The CIA was coming to get them, that they were surrounded in the jungle and that they were going to come in and torture them and kill them. So he had this notion implanted in the people that they were in danger. And he would show them movies of the experiments during the Holocaust at the death camps. And he would show them these horrible, depressive movies and say, well, this is what can happen to us. And this is why we need to have a plan for revolutionary suicide. And because he believed in reincarnation, and he taught his followers to believe in reincarnation, he told them that they would be merely passing over peacefully to the other side if they drank this potion, that they would live on forever.
Julia, finally, how did Jim Jones actually get his followers to drink the poison?
They were surrounded by armed guards with guns that were trained on them. And so, and this is what most people don't remember or don't realize. They didn't have any choice. He gave them two outcomes. They could either drink the poisoned punch or they could be shot to death.
And parents were even told to give the poison drink to their children before drinking it themselves, right?
Right. The parents, they killed the babies first. And the mothers that refused to give over their babies had them wrenched from their arms.
It just goes against human nature.
It is. And it's horrifying. If you listen to the death tape, because Jones taped everything, you can hear the children screaming and the mothers screaming. And it's just the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. You can find it online, and it's highly disturbing. Those people did not want to die, and they did not want to kill their children. They were forced to do so.
Truly horrifying. Julia Shears, author of 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks for having me.
According to the 2013 Nielsen report, baby boomers are nearly 80 million strong, making us the largest, richest, and most involved age demographic in the United States. Yet, there is this middle-age stigma that often portrays us as being past our prime.
But according to the New York Times reporter Patricia Cohen, the idea of middle age is simply a manufactured stage of modern life. In her new book, In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age, Patricia tells us why it can be the best years of our lives and a time of extravagant possibilities. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Hi.
Great to have you. Tell us what you mean when you say middle age was invented.
Well, I know that sounds odd to people, right? That it's invented. And of course, obviously, people always live to their 40s, their 50s, their 60s. But middle age, in terms of the way that we think about it, is really something that is very specific to a culture, a particular culture, and all of the various associations that we have about it. If you go back a few hundred years, think about it, old age was thought of as that's the time when you had the most wisdom and experience. Even think about why did people wear powdered wigs a couple hundred years ago? Because they wanted to look older, right? Imagine that today, now in our culture, everybody's trying to look younger.
So, Patricia, how would you define middle age today? I mean, is there a chronological number where just like poof, we're middle age, and then poof, it suddenly ends and we're just old?
Well, in fact, the more that I did research on middle age, the more that I realized that, in fact, the chronological number was, in a way, the least helpful way to think about aging in middle age. And in fact, just to set it up, what is the date, right? When do you start middle age? And surveys really are all over the board. So if you ask people when do they think middle age begins and when does it end, women actually think it starts later than men do. Younger people think it starts earlier. Surveys have showed that people think middle age goes into your early 70s. So really what I found is more sociological. In other words, what are you doing socially? Where are you in terms of raising your children? Where are you in your job? Have your parents died yet? All of those things are really much more significant markers in terms of the way we think about being middle age. It's kind of what stage are you along the life course in terms of children, in terms of work, family, that kind of thing.
Patricia, you found that the concept of middle age changes from one generation to the next, and you use as an example, which is just fantastic, The character of Norma Desmond, the washed-up silent movie star in the 50s movie Sunset Boulevard, who is supposed to be like 50 years old. Of course, she's already washed up. And then you contrast that with a more recent Sex and the City movie where that sexy, youthful Kim Cattrall is celebrating her 50th in wild style, shall we say. So times have really kind of changed, haven't they?
Exactly. Although cultural stereotypes, and most powerfully, really, that come across in television and movies, still really do exalt youth. And so on the one hand, yes, the kind of fantastic character of Kim Cattrall in Sex and the City. But I did a whole chapter on movies, and one of the things I remember was a 2003 or 4 movie that starred Brad Pitt as Alexander the Great. And they had as his middle-aged mother, Angelina Jolie, I think it was. She was like a year older than he was. So in all of these movies, if you think about it, we always see these pairings of older men who were 20, 25 years older than the actresses that they're paired with and are supposed to be their equivalent. So I do think that movies, even though depictions of middle age are better than they were, still think about how many movies you see starring middle-aged women. I mean, other than Helen Mirren or Meryl Streep, you know, there really aren't a lot.
But they're actually pretty popular, aren't they? Because there aren't any that depict real-life middle-aged people.
Exactly. Fortunately, I think television has become a much more fertile and interesting ground to see depictions of women in middle age.
Well, Patricia, let's talk about what you coin the midlife industrial complex, which I love, that seems to sort of invent these conditions that really prey on our middle age anxieties. Can you give us some examples of what you mean?
About hair coloring. I mean, we started out talking about that powdered wigs. You know, what is it that became suddenly that it was a bad sign to have gray hair? Well, Clairol, for instance, and a lot of other manufacturers of hair coloring products, you could have 20-minute at-home, do-it-yourself hair coloring. So then you had all of these commercials suddenly that showed gray hair, that must be the reason she's alone, or that's the reason that she's a wallflower, or her husband looks so much younger than she does. Why? Because her hair is gray. And so it's this barrage of marketing messages kind of creating illnesses or creating things that are wrong with you so then they can sell you a product to fix the feeling. And we're seeing the exact same thing happening now in terms of Botox and facial fillers and anti-aging creams and all of these things that keep kind of blasting at you all the time that it's ugly to have wrinkles. It's ugly to look older, and therefore you need to buy these products.
And Patricia, I have to tell you, if I see one more erectile dysfunction commercial on TV,
I know.
I'm going to scream.
I know.
But what's with that?
Well, part of the reason why we see so many of those commercials, which are aimed at middle-aged and older people, is because younger people don't watch television in the numbers that they used to. And so, which is ironic, because on the one hand, you have all of the shows which are looking at demographics and how they always want to charge more for commercial if you have a younger audience. And yet at the same time, their most loyal audiences on television are middle-aged people, and yet they're kind of given the shaft. But so advertisers, that's a way that they know that they can reach a middle-aged audience because middle-aged people watch TV in greater numbers perhaps than any other group. And also, interestingly, if we're talking about the midlife industrial complex, why are there so many commercials for erectile dysfunction? A lot of healthcare benefits pay for that. Think of all of the things, even like most basic things for women, contraception, that are not paid for by medical plans, but yet that is.
You are listening to Two Boomer Babes, and we're talking with journalist and author Patricia Cohen about the phenomenon of middle age, why it was recently invented, and how it keeps morphing. Her book is called In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. Patricia, you also talk about the inherent contradiction between middle-aged women who are more educated and accomplished in the workplace than ever before, and the enormous emphasis on appearance and pressure to look youthful. So isn't that an enormous contradiction? I mean, we're all trying to like keep up with Demi Moore and Madonna.
Right.
It's
exactly.
Not easy.
You know, it's very interesting that you said that. I moderated a panel recently, and I interviewed actresses Maggie Gyllenhaal, Lucy Liu, Taylor Schilling, who is in Orange is the New Black, and Mira Sorvino, and we started to talk about the pressure on appearance. And they, these gorgeous actresses that we kind of hold up as our icons of beauty, were complaining about even the pressure on them to always look picture perfect and how it's so much a part of the marketing of whatever show they're on. It's really oppressive. And my response is, well, you feel that way. Okay, so imagine what the rest of us feel like, because here we have Jennifer Aniston, for instance, who's held out as this is what you're supposed to look like when you're 45. Most 45-year-old women don't look like that. And so it causes this very self-reinforcing negative cycle where we feel we don't live up to what we're supposed to look like. And I think it's just really damaging. I mean, obviously, look, we all want to look the best we can, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? But it's when it becomes these images that are just really unnatural and unreal about being youthful and looking youthful and valuing youth in a culture.
Well, Patricia, just take a look at the two boomer babes, and you'll just be pumped up. She has her fingers crossed. I do. Patricia Cohen, author of In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Up next, update and decorate with flair. Tips from one of HGTV's top decorators. Stay with us.
Our next guest has designed his way across America, making over homes and restaurants for TLC's Trading Spaces and NBC's Home Intervention. Vern Yip joins us to talk about his latest project and to share affordable tips on how to renovate and update just about any space. Welcome, Vern.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So, Vern, tell us about your recent show, Live in Vern's House, where you actually built your own beach house of your dreams. I mean, we want that gig.
I know. Who doesn't want that gig, right?
Right.
You know, I dreamed of building this house for such a long time and collected things for it for over a decade for a non-existent beach house. And so it was finally time. You know, everybody was calling me an upscale hoarder because my entire garage was filled with furniture for a house that didn't actually exist. So it was fun because I built the house and we chronicled it for this Live in Vern's House show that premiered this past July 12th on HGTV and was also in HGTV magazine in a big spread. And it was just really wonderful. You know, it was wonderful to be able to fulfill that dream. And what's really special now is that we are offering one HGTV superfan and one Vern Yip superfan the opportunity to actually vacation in this house for an entire week with their families.
Oh, where do we sign up?
Yeah.
I know.
So, Vern, we want to get some tips from you because we want our homes to have that kind of designer feel, but, you know, still have some personality and character. And we don't want it to look cluttered. You know, we're not too demanding here. So can you give us some tips on how to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing that you should always remember is that you don't really have to spend a lot of money to have a beautiful home that really reflects your personal style. You know, people get very, very caught up in trying to replicate a look in a magazine or replicate a look that they see in the store. And really, at the end of the day, it should feel uniquely like your home. And once you kind of free yourself of trying to make it look like somebody else's home, you really discover that you can be super creative with your budget because you can really mix and layer things from flea markets and vintage sales or, you know, give things a facelift that maybe look a little time-worn and update them with new hardware. So lots of great tricks that you can use as soon as you start to get creative. And then the second thing I would say is we all live with a ton of clutter, you know, especially any of us who have kids. I've got 2 toddlers and 4 dogs, and I have a lot of stuff. And one of the big tricks as a designer that I always like to employ is to make sure that there's plenty of closed storage. So instead of lots of bookshelves and open surfaces where people can kind of see your clutter and your mess, you need to have lots of pieces that have doors and drawers where you can just put things away and, you know, close the door or shut that drawer and get it out of sight.
Well, you mentioned kids and dogs, and I am like Miss Sentimentality. I love pictures of my children from every stage and age. So what is too much, you know, or how can you assemble those family photos and not make it look like it's a museum to the fam?
I don't think that there's anything wrong with wanting to be surrounded by pictures of the people that you love and sometimes the animals that you love. I think that that's great. But the one thing to always keep in mind is that you want to kind of create some sort of visual link so it looks like a grouping and it doesn't just look totally thrown together. And, you know, a visual link can be something as simple as saying, you know what, all of my frames are going to be in a silver finish, or all of my frames are going to be dark wood, or, you know, just pick something that's a visual link, and then that lets you have the freedom to kind of pick different styles and then still have it come together and look great. The other thing I always say is editing is wonderful. It's free, and it really makes your stuff look great, because what you'll notice is when you, even if you have that visual link, you get to that tipping point where, you know, it begins to look a little bit like a yard sale. And, you know, by editing and just kind of rotating things out throughout the year, meaning that not everything that you own has to be on display, you can have half of the things that you own on display for half of the year, and then the other half of the year you can switch it out. But by giving things a little more space to be appreciated, it'll look a lot nicer and it'll feel a lot less cluttered and be less stressful.
Let me ask you about colors for this season. What are the hot trends? My house could certainly use a little updating, to put it nicely.
Well, color is always something that people are excited to talk about. And we are kind of seeing a lot of corals and a lot of oranges that verge into the coral territory. Orange has been a big color for a long time now, but it's been kind of a warmer orange that we've seen a lot of. Now we're kind of like moving into more of an orange coral area, and that's really kind of trending. We're seeing a lot of that. And we're also seeing a lot of turquoise coming back, and we're also seeing a lot of dark kind of jade colors coming back, but things that are basically vibrant.
Oh, I'm so excited. You've gotten me going. I can't wait to go home and get painting. Now, listen, what if we're going to redo a kitchen? Are painted cabinets in? Are they out? Is dark wood in? Is it out? I'm so confused.
You know, what's in is doing it correctly. So if you are going to paint your cabinets, absolutely, you can make it look great, make it look relevant for today, but you have to do a good job of it. Make sure you sand it properly, and then you paint it with a paint that's meant to be wipeable and cleanable, because we want our kitchens to be, you know, nice and clean. But we are seeing a huge resurgence in white cabinets. We've been seeing that for a couple of years now. People love white kitchens. And we also are seeing a mixture of white with dark. So a lot of people are, like, for example, choosing to go with a dark wood island, but then the rest of their cabinetry is white. So we're seeing sort of the extremes. What I'm not seeing too much of right now are those mid-tones. So I'm not seeing a lot of blonde woods. I'm not seeing a lot of cherry woods. I'm not seeing a lot of, you know, lighter woods. I'm seeing kind of the extremes.
And then I've also seen a lot of mixing up of different kinds of countertops within a kitchen, which is sort of interesting.
It is. It's really interesting, but keep in mind that that's a trend that you really only want to embrace if you have a big kitchen. If your kitchen is medium or it's small in size, breaking up the countertops really kind of makes your kitchen feel even smaller, because what you're trying to do is use the same materials in as many locations as possible. And what that does is it makes your kitchen feel larger than it really is.
Okay, Vern, we got to go. But a real quick tip for some bathroom renovations, especially if we've still got that 60s turquoise blue tub.
Make a custom, if you don't have a glass shower enclosure, you could go for that, or a glass enclosure for your tub. But if you don't have the money to do that, do a custom shower curtain and bring it up to the top of the ceiling. It changes the look of your bathroom dramatically.
Vern Yip, decorator and television personality, we babes have picked up some great tips for our own in our dreams renovations. Thanks so much for sharing your savvy advice.
There's a big controversy brewing about an annual ritual for middle-aged men, the prostate-specific antigen test, or PSA, which screens for early prostate cancer. The test was approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in the late 80s, and by 2008, it had become mainstream as nearly half of men over 50 reported they had been screened in the past 12 months.
Recent studies show, however, that this routine test may not save lives and could result in healthy men receiving unnecessary treatment that could injure or even kill them. So what's a man to do? In the thick of the discussion is Dr. Richard Ablin, a professor of pathology at the University of Arizona College of Medicine and the scientist often cited as having discovered the prostate-specific antigen. He's also the author of The Great Prostate Hoax. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, can we just begin and have you tell us, what is the PSA test? How does it even work?
Basically, what the PSA test is a protein which is referred to as prostate-specific antigen, which I identified in 1970. And this antigen is used in different types of immunological tests. The purpose of it is that by taking the protein and exposing it to serum from a patient, and the immunological reaction of the protein with the corresponding antibody occurs, and then this can be measured or visualized. Now, what's important to understand and appreciate is that the test that was approved in 1984, where PSA and the PSA test should be used as what we call a harbinger for the recurrence of the disease. That is, when a man has been diagnosed with prostate cancer and treated, whether it be by a radical prostatectomy, radiation, or some other form of therapy, that following treatment, the test is extremely useful to look for the presence of PSA in the serum because of the fact that because of the definition of the protein, prostate-specific antigen, this protein is only present in the prostate gland. So therefore, if the prostate is surgically removed or radiated, there should not be any source of this protein in the serum of the patient who was treated. And if one starts to see an indication of the presence of this antigen, that is an indication that either all of the tumor wasn't removed at the time of treatment or killed, or that at the time of diagnosis, the test that was used to determine the extent of the disease was not sensitive enough, and that at the time the patient may have had cancer spread beyond the prostate, which we call metastasis. This test is generally, for that purpose, is accepted. Now, in 1994, the Food and Drug Administration made a terrible mistake, and that is they approved this test for the use of detection of prostate cancer. And the reason why this is a mistake, and this is the subject of the book and the multi-billion dollar industry that was built up around a test that can't do what it's purported to do, is because this protein is specific for the prostate, but it's not cancer specific. The same protein is found in not only the cancerous or the malignant prostate, it's found in the benign prostate, and it's also present in the normal prostate. So the test cannot do what it's purported to do, and so therefore it's important. We're talking about the use of the test not for prognosis following treatment, but as a means to detect prostate cancer, which has led to the overdiagnosis and overtreatment of millions of men.
So, doctor, is that why then with this test there can be false positives and also false negatives?
Yes, there can be up to 80% false positives. And at the time when the FDA was meeting in 1994, well, actually in 1993, to review the panel, two panel members made very succinct and important statements. One panel member on the advisory board said that if you approve, you know, of this test, like Pontius Pilate, you can't wash your hands of the blood. And then the other person who was on here said that this is the most important medical story in the last 30 years.
Well, doctor, let me ask you, what percentage of prostate cancers found with the screening, the initial screening, are actually slow growing and confined to the gland?
The majority of men who are screened have localized disease. And the difficulty with the PSA test, which is important to appreciate, is that because PSA is not cancer specific, it can't detect prostate cancer. Second, there is no level or dichotomy for PSA, because a man can have a PSA of 0.5 and have cancer, and a PSA of 11 and not have cancer. And so I say we have two types of prostate cancer. I analogize them to turtles and rabbits, you know, in an open box. A turtle crawls around a box and goes nowhere. And that's the majority of what prostate cancer is in man. The other animal I analogize in the box is a rabbit, which is analogized to an aggressive prostate cancer. And the rabbit can jump out of the box at any time and metastasize. And so the problem here is with the PSA test, and I refer to these as the four cruxes, of which I've given you three, is that when you do a PSA test, you can't determine whether it's a rabbit or it's a turtle. And the last and most important is prostate cancer is a disease that is age-related. If we have a group of men between the age of 60 and 69 years of age, if we do a biopsy on those men, we'll find that 65% of those men have prostate cancer. And the tragedy of all of this is that because we can't tell the difference between a rabbit and a turtle, many men who are turtles are treated and suffer the consequences of impotency and incontinence. And when you talk about incontinence, you know, it's a word, but if you think about it, is that if you're a 50, 60-year-old man and you're incontinent and you have to change your diapers 10 times a day and wear plastic pants, it gives you a more vivid picture of what incontinence is. And not only are these, you know, problems in terms of quality of life, but they also have a very important psychological effect on a man. And if you consider that this test, once it was approved in 86, was being used by urologists and other healthcare people for 8 years off-label, which is criminal. 3% of men will die from prostate cancer. 97% of men won't die from prostate cancer.
But, doctor, what about that small amount that does have the lethal form of prostate cancer? How do you even find out you have it then?
That's the difficulty. The difficulty is that the only way that you can really tell whether a man has prostate cancer or not is to do a biopsy. And when you do a biopsy, it's a picture in time. It's not a dynamic continuum. You look at it and you see what it is. So that's why what a lot of men are doing and what the urological community has come to realize is that they're doing a CYA. I don't know if you know what it is.
No, what is that?
Well, cover your ass.
Oh.
And okay, the reason for that is so many men have a diagnosis of prostate cancer. They're not sure if it's a rabbit or a turtle.
So, doctor, the bottom line, what would you advise men over 50 to do?
If you have a family history of prostate cancer, if your father had prostate cancer, there's a 2-to-1 chance that you'll have it. If your brother had it, there's a 3-to-1. So if a man has a family history of prostate cancer, he may want to have a PSA test with the understanding, very important, that this test in by itself cannot detect prostate cancer. He gets a number, a 2, a 3, a 1, a 6, whatever it is. He writes down that number, and then the following year or 6 months later when he goes for a physical, he has another PSA test. And he watches that, and he looks at this, as I analogize it, to a fire alarm and a smoke alarm. When a smoke alarm goes off, it does not necessarily mean that there's a fire. Similarly, if one is following their PSA and their PSA goes up, that doesn't mean that they have cancer, because there are two other diseases of the prostate, prostatitis, which is caused by an infection or diet, and benign prostatic hypertrophy, which is an enlargement of the prostate, which all men start to acquire after the age of 40, which also can cause an elevation in PSA. So that's one approach. Also, African Americans have a tendency to present at a much higher stage of disease or aggressiveness than Caucasians. And so if you're an African American, you may wish to have your PSA and then follow it. You have to understand that this is also very difficult, because most people, when they hear the word cancer, which is probably the most feared word in any language anywhere in the world, the tendency is, I want to cut this out. But of all the different types of cancer, prostate cancer is still cancer, and I'm not, making light of it. While it can be a deadly disease, in most cases, it's a turtle.
If you're like us babes, you're glued to your chair in front of a computer screen for hours each day, or you're sitting in lots of long meetings where walking around just isn't an option. So how do we get our blood flowing and reactivate those brain cells while stuck in a chair?
Susan Shane has some answers. She's a licensed acupuncturist and wellness lecturer at college campuses and corporations across the country. Susan joins us on the phone from San Diego to shoot the breeze about simple desk exercises. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so Susan, can you take us through a few simple exercises to do at our desk?
The very first step is just to remember to breathe. Put one hand on your abdomen, one hand on your chest, and inhale. Try to get the inhale as big as you can, as comfortably as you can. Then exhale and see if your hands move in unison and the same amount. Try that for a couple times so you really feel your breath. And then a real simple exercise, because your neck gets tight from sitting at the desk and just looking at the computer, you can use your inhale. Fill up the air, then as you exhale, you want to take your shoulders up to your ears and then return right back down.
Sounds like Lamaze, kind of.
Doing it.
Are you saying we're always breathing while we're doing these simple exercises?
Well, hope so. We'll be dead if we're not.
Deep breathing.
You have to exhale the whole time you move, and you prepare by inhaling. You don't move. You inhale. Then as you exhale and let all that tension, then you move and you can stretch and relax. It's really energizing.
Okay. So, Susan, I know my shoulders really ache when typing away on my computer screen. So what other exercises can we do really for those shoulders?
The other one besides the shrug, where you lift up to your ear and then return, is you can do a shoulder roll. So just inhale, fill up with a lot of air. Then as you breathe out and exhale, take your shoulder and make a circle, roll in one direction, keep breathing out. Then you can inhale, and as you get ready to exhale, circle the other direction. So you are shoulder rolling with the breath.
So are we supposed to hear a few creaks and groans?
You will hear a crack.
Okay, that's crackling perfectly sound. Normal, right,
and what
Susan?
About alternating the shoulders? I mean, it makes it a little bit more fun.
It gives you choices, it gives you variety, and it just helps the circulation.
Great. Now, what about the lower body?
A really fun exercise while you're sitting in your chair is you have the inhale, you don't move, but as you exhale, you just rock your tailbone a little bit up, and then you go back to your original position. So you're just rocking your tailbone a little bit forward, and then you go back to sitting up very straight. So inhale, and then exhale, rock that tailbone a little bit forward, and then come right back sitting up really straight.
I'm assuming we should have a tight core while we're doing this?
You can feel your core. I'm more interested that you're filling up with a lot of air, and then as you exhale, you feel that exhale. Does your core get tight? For some people, yes. For other people, it just may be just that they've exhaled. They may not feel their core that much, and I'm okay with that. I want them to be aware of their core.
You also have this movement called the shaker, which I tried, and I love that one. So tell us how you do that and what it's for.
The shaker will relax your thigh muscles, and it will help your lower back relax. This one, you can't be sitting in a chair. You have to lie on your back, and you bend your knees with your feet planted on the floor. The first step is you bring your knee toward your chest, and you inhale. Then the step two is you bring your toes up to the ceiling, so you're flexing your foot. Step three is you start to exhale and feel your heel go real long up toward the ceiling, and it will naturally just start to shake. And you just let that go as long as you're exhaling, and then you return back to the very first position where your knee is in towards your chest.
Okay, so that's where we have our own private office and we can shut the door and lay on the floor, right?
Yeah, you can try this with the door shut. And you will see that when the natural shaking occurs, all that pain and pressure and tightness in your thighs and in your lower back and gluteal muscles goes away.
Wellness expert Susan Chain, this has been invigorating. Thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zyma Communications.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.